Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by Dragonmount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fourth Age podcast's continuing recap of Towers of Midnight. With me this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be here as always, and it's always fun to go through the Towers of Midnight again. And also with us this episode, we have the redoubtable Spencer.
Welcome, everyone. We are going to continue with our reread of Towers of Midnight, as Andrew said. This week we are starting on Chapter 4. And as you might have guessed, since we are rereading Towers of Midnight, we are going to have spoilers for every book in the series. So if you haven't finished the entire series, why are you in the middle of a T of M reread? Anyway, so you may want to wait and listen to these podcasts later. I say these podcasts because it's a series of Towers of Midnight reread.
We'll also try not to spoil every other series that you might possibly have ever read, which we do sometimes inadvertently.
Incidentally, if you happen to like spoilers, go ahead and listen. Seriously. I mean, I never get any emails at all that say, hey, I don't actually mind spoilers, and I was listening to this podcast, and it made me think about this and this and this. What's up with that? Honestly, if you enjoy spoilers, go ahead and listen to the podcast because it'll generate a lot of feedback.
Yeah, if you like spoilers, call us and leave us a voicemail.
So we'll begin our read-through episode, this time with Chapter 4, The Pattern Groans. Perrin is riding Stair on the Jehanna Road with Fael, Will, Saonid, and the Six Wise Ones. Berlane, Honora, Galen are also there. Aleandre has stayed behind. The area they investigate has mysteriously developed signs of blight infection. Mori claims that it is encompassing the entire patch. They ride into the patch and find a strange village in the middle, and Sulin reports that no one is occupying the village. Missouri says that the wood and thatch are something she has never seen. Perrin orders the Wise Ones to burn the entire area. Later that evening, Perrin is reading a copy of The Travels of Jane Farstrider, which Gaul has found in Malden. As he is reading, he falls asleep and enters the wolf dream. There, the sky, as usual of late, contains the same strange storm that we've seen across the last book and into this one. Hopper, Oak Dancer, Whisperer, Morning Light, Sparks, and Boundless invite him to a hunt. Remembering Gnome in Jara, Perrin refuses to give in. He starts with a Two Rivers longbow. He is not as good a shot as Jondan Baron, but then he eventually reverts to his wolf form, mainly due to the influence of the wolves laughing at him and sending very amusing images of Perrin's various choices of weaponry. Hopper chides him once again for worrying too much. While in the wolf dream, Perrin has a set of visions. Matt fighting against himself, a dozen different men wearing Matt's face, all dressed in different types of fine clothing, never seeing a shadowy figure creeping up behind him with a bloody knife. The second vision is sheep running in a flock toward the woods, chased by wolves. A terrible beast waits unseen in the woods, and something, Perrin thinks, is wrong with the wolves. The final vision is Fael, Grady, Elias, and Gaul, followed by thousands of others, walking toward the edge of a cliff. Perrin scents a stag and gives chase. He hunts the stag as a wolf would and manages to bring it down eventually, but before he is able to introduce a killing bite, Hopper knocks him away. Hopper says that they hunt, but they do not kill, because in the wolf dream, death is final. Perrin agrees to let Hopper teach him his way. The POV then shifts to Galad, who is riding Stout through the camp near the Jehanna Road. They plan to continue north and avoid the Shaunchan and the Dragon Reborn's armies. He orders the questioners to disperse among the other Children of the Light, Lords Captain Voradin, Gulver, and Harnesh ride with him. Galad is sending a letter to the other questioners who did not follow Asunawa, commanding them to report to him. The other Lords Captain are uncomfortable with Galad's plans to ally with the Aes Sedai to fight in the last battle. Vyar returns early from scouting. They captured dozens of prisoners on the Jehanna Road. Galad orders Bornhold to separate and question them. Their leader is a man named Basil Gill. He tells a story that he is heading to Abu Dhar to trade with a merchant, Fallen Devoshara. Bornhold soon returns and reports that their leader is Perrin Ibarra, the man who killed Bornhold's father.
So there's some interesting stuff in this, and I think I kind of want to start with this vision that he has. He does have three. The one with the sheep running in a flock towards the woods, and Thel, Grady, Elias, and Gaul, and other thousands of others walking off or towards the cliff, get talked about later on in the book, in later chapters. But this one, Matt fighting against himself, a dozen different men wearing his face, all dressed in different types of fine clothing. Yet he never sees the shadowy figure behind him. What do you think that is?
I don't know. I kind of missed that one when I went through the book, and it's a lot.
The first half of it, I would almost say that it's something that is referring to Matt himself. He's fighting the various hims, the various personas that he tends to kind of adopt. I mean, Matt's a complex person for being as simple as he is. And it is very possible that, you know, that might be it. Now, granted, that's a little awkward because we also know that Matt is currently being hounded, I think much like Perrin is, where people have handed out, well, Dark Friends, the Forsaken. Somebody has handed out various portraits of Matt and Perrin. For some reason, I've always associated this vision with that in some way, shape, or form, because we do know that there are assassins consistently coming after Matt. But I don't really know. It seems like something that is going to end up showing up in the next book, in my opinion.
I can't think of anything we've seen in this book that would still fulfill that, unless it's somehow talking about the Sin, but I don't think it doesn't feel like that.
The largest problem with it is that shadowy figure sneaking up behind with the bloody knife. I mean, that really seems odd. And, you know, and I would almost say, you know, there could be another bubble of evil thing like Rand with all of the mirror image Rands all over the place, but that's already been done. And I can't really see them making a huge enough error to repeat something that was clever once, but wouldn't work on a consistently repeating scale.
Yeah. And you know, that brought to mind something that Brandon said recently in his, he was doing his Wheel of Time reread, and I'm gonna see if I can find it real quick, but basically said, kind of interesting, the first bubble of evil we saw, but the first one that we kind of actually recognized there in Ibu Dhar is really foretelling of the things that are to come with the different voids. I mean, we think of Rand, who fought with different versions of himself until he realized that the way to beat them was to absorb them all into one being. Perrin, who was attacked by his axe, and Matt, who was attacked by the Amarlin playing card. And he talked a little bit, and I wish I could find it, because I can't remember exactly what he said about each of them. But he said that each of them was very foretelling of the way things were to be later. And so I wonder if we haven't seen all of what's in store for Matt just based off of that earlier foretelling that RJ put in there.
Yeah, all three of those instances of the Bubbles of Evil were when they were first occupying the Stone of Tyr. As I remember now, because it was during Matt's phase of complaining over how Nobleman only wanted to play cards and how his luck didn't run so well with cards. You know, wished for a really good dice game. Instead, we've begun something, and we mentioned it in the last podcast, but this one is even more apparent. When you pay close attention at the very beginning of both points of view in this chapter, is that, oh, hey, look, they're both camped and riding near the Johanna Road. You know, so this kind of foreshadows that Perrin and Galad are going to be intricately linked through the whole book. This is a good thing because Perrin is going toward, or, you know, going back toward Rand, and and Galad will eventually have to come into contact, and that there could be a familial understanding once the two half-brothers actually meet. One of the interesting things here in Perrin's point of view is the Blight Patch and the weird island village, because honestly, that's what it is. It's a very, very obviously an island village.
Yeah, it's definitely out of place. It reminds me a little bit of the village that showed up in a few books earlier that basically showed up and melted back into the ground, taking a peddler with it. But this one was deserted. I found it interesting that Perrin just automatically decides to order the wise ones to burn the thing in all the bright infected area to the ground. That seemed like a, you know, Perrin so frequently waffles around on stuff, what to do and everything like that. And boy, he just whipped that command decision right out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and honestly, it's a good thing. And I think that basically comes down to Perrin realizing it's like, ooh, if the Blight's showing up in other places, and we know that the Blight tries to spread south or has spread south, you know, if a patch of it just shows up in the middle of Andor or something, you know, we should probably lance that boil before it grows any bigger. And, you know, the last thing we need is a second Blight sprouting up in the middle of, you know, the continent.
Yeah.
No, it's a very interesting thing about Perrin is that when he's in these situations, here, you know, Fael was captured another time just all along the way. When someone absolutely has to take the lead, no one else is seeing what he's seeing. No one else is taking the initiative to get stuff done. And he'll step right in there without any hesitation, and he won't even think about it later that he was being their leader right then. And he does it all throughout this book, and it's really not until, I'm not sure what chapter it is anymore, but that when he finally decides, I'm going to be a leader, that he's conscious that something has to be done. You know, at that point, it's the fact that the White Cloaks are going to get themselves killed in this trap that was set for me, and so we have to go back and save them. Something has to be done. I have to go back and do this, and it's not until then that he's really conscious of the fact that when the chips are down, he'll step up and be a leader.
This is very true.
Side thing, the sheep running in a flock towards the woods, chased by wolves with a terrible beast waits unseen. Apparently, that's actually the foretelling of him kind of pushing the White Cloak into the trap that was laid for him.
Spoiler warning. Too late.
We will discuss this again when the appropriate chapters come up. This will be the podcast that deals with probably either chapter 34 or chapter 40. One of the later chapters in the book.
Yeah, 41 would actually hit that.
I also really liked the wolf dream hunt. The idea that the wolves are all, and Perrin thinks about the fact that they're all laughing at him in their own wolfish way. Because he imagines the bow, and he hits the bow, and the wolves start laughing at him, and you suddenly see the bull, and it's spitting at the deer. And then, you know, later he's like, okay, fine. And, you know, he imagines the hammer, and then suddenly they're imagining the bull jumping up and down on top of the deer. And just, the image is so funny that I think it shows up again later in the book with Perrin just as the bull jumping up and down on top of the poor deer. And I just, yeah, it's a hilarious image. I honestly want a piece of fan art that with deer jumping up and down on top.
Yeah. Who would have ever thought wolves had such a sense of humor, huh?
Oh, yeah. And they're merciless about it, too. I mean, they're almost Aiel in their viciousness and humor.
you can well, yeah, imagine imagine these wolves with a big grin, just kind of chuckling. But yeah, the wolves can't be up and down. So.
And again, it was, it's also really kind of, in my mind, as you know, they're chasing down the deer, I completely forgot. It's like, oh, that's right, you know, everything that dies in the wolf dream dies, and dies the final death this time around, the wheel. It's like, you know, I had forgotten that. I remembered that it happened for wolves, and it happened for people, but even, like, you know, random animals that die and are in the wolf dream, like, you know, deer and stuff, anything that dies in the wolf dream dies permanently. And I was just like, oh, I completely forgot that. And so it was kind of a sobering reminder, and nice, because, like I said, these are those weird things that, as we read through a series, we tend to forget certain things, much like the battle in the White Tower, you know, where there was, where at some point there is part of the battle going on inside the world of dreams, and that it seems to me it's like we kind of forgot a few things, and I think a couple of things didn't get mentioned in the book that possibly should have, that would have made it easier to remember that. But again, we'll get to those chapters later.
And of course, you know, it is another foreshadowing of something that happens later in the book that I'm not going to spoil this one.
Yes, the Johanna Road.
Everyone
again,
knows
too.
What it is.
Everyone?
Everyone's on the Johanna Road.
Follow Johanna Road. Follow Johanna
everyone
Road.
Everyone who's read Towers of Midnight knows what I'm talking about when I say that here's final result is foreshadowing something.
Yeah, but not all of us will remember.
Follow the Johanna Road. If ever a Rand there was, the Randall Thor is one because Lucifer is just a voice in his head.
Oh, I thought you were going to do the Johanna Road was ever on.
Well, yeah, there's the White Cloaks and Yolod, who has had enough, you know, actual world experience that isn't in the kind of sheltered confines of Amidithia that lets them know the Aes Sedai aren't all bad, and we are going to need their help if we want to kill everything or win the last battle.
Oh. Yeah. There's that. There's also, it's a nice point that Galad does send messengers back to the Seanchan held lands so that other questioners and children of the light who did not follow either Asunua or himself would have a chance. And, you know, and Galad thinks to himself, it's like he's not really counting on getting any more people than he already has, but hey, it's worth a shot.
Yeah.
So I kind of liked that.
You know, this is kind of like the split in the tower, only the Children of the Light are a whole lot smarter and they take care of it in the matter of, a week.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just pointing that out, Galad is a much better leader than Egwene in this circumstance. Egwene is a great leader, don't get me wrong, but the fact that Galad could get the Children of the Light back together in a matter of a couple weeks, whereas she didn't try and get them back together. No, instead she tried to wage war against the opposing faction. What? I'm sorry. I'm going to shut up now. All right, we're going to move on to Chapter 5, Writing. There's three point of views here. We're going to split it into two sections. And the first section is from Gawain and then Egwene. And it starts with Gawain's point of view, and he and Sleet are walking through the White Tower to the apartment where one of the White Aja was murdered. She was the fourth victim in a few days. They have all been killed with knives. Chubain is also there. He is the leader. What is the actual title of the leader of the Tower Guard? I don't know. But he feels threatened as his Tower Guard were defeated by Brine, and Gawain is Morghese's son. Chubain doesn't really know where he stands right now. Sleet finds a thread of black silk. They think it might be a gray man. Chubain takes the thread to Sien to examine. Hattori still will go on as a second warder. I believe that is Sleet. I think Hattori still is Sleet, Aes Sedai. Gawain goes to see Egwene, but he is blocked by Sylviana, who makes him wait. Many of his younglings are now warders. Once he is finally admitted to see Egwene, they argue about his protecting her. He wants to order more sisters to bond warders for their protection. He insists that the assassin is Mesaana, but they argue some more about it, and then he finally leaves in a huff.
Then we switch to Egwene's point of view, and we find that Egwene is frustrated. She loves Gawain, but he will not respect her authority. She is writing a letter to the new king of Tyr, Darlin Cisnera, asking his support to prevent Rand from breaking the seals that hold the Dark One's prison. She makes a mental note that her tea tastes better than normal. That's a fairly short little point of view for her.
Yeah, and there's not really much in this other than Gwan and Egwene are having a spat. Not really a lover's spat yet, but they are having a spat. Gawain needs to get bonded. Tori still wants to bond him, which, you know, we kind of bleed brothers in arms, which would be cool. I won't deny that. But I think the only thing really of note here is that they're both wrong that about who the assassin is, and that the tea tastes better than normal because the Dragon Reborn was there just a few days previous.
Yes, anyone who has read very well through the previous book, The Gathering Storm, should be able to piece together who the assassin is. I mean, I rejoiced in this chapter the instant there was even an eighth of a clue as to who the assassin was, because I was like, yes, I wanted an answer to that question in the last book, and now I'm finally getting it. So it was very nice that this book will give us an answer to who the assassin is, but it doesn't take a whole lot of really deep investigation to figure out who the assassin is.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, even in the even in this very short summary of the chapter, there are two very specific clues as to who the assassin is. And yes, it is. I was very happy with that, because I was kind of beating my head, you know, against the table that certain people who were around for late events in the last book in The Gathering Storm didn't catch on quicker.
Yeah.
So
I'll be perfectly honest, at the speed that I did my first read through, a lot of these things I just kind of took it and kept going because I wanted to, you know, finish the book so that we could talk about it. And so I kind of assumed that Egwene was right. I don't know why. I just kind of assumed, yeah, it's the Black Ajah coming and murdering sisters randomly because they can. I mean, she had had the dream. She knew that Mesaana was killing sisters, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when we finally find out who it is, I'm like, so, of course.
I also think it's a little amusing that, you know, Egwene is, now that she's Ammerlin, she's like, I'm gonna get involved in the politics of the world, and so she's writing to Darlan to ask for support in preventing Rand from breaking the seals, when there wouldn't be a King of Tyr at all if Rand hadn't given Darlan the crown.
Yeah, exactly.
Moreover, recreated the position of king in Tyr.
After how many?
I don't know
years?
About that one so much. Because wasn't Darlan appointed king because the whatever they're called, the, I want to say deserters, that's not right, but the people who were fighting against Rand in Tyr would go back and rejoin the actual country, and if Darlan was appointed king.
Nope.
Yeah, but the thing is, go ahead, Virginia.
Sorry. Okay.
No, I was going to say, you sounded like you had a thought there, so go ahead.
Not a good one. Go ahead.
No, I my thought was, again, I might not be remembering correctly, I had thought that Darlan was one of those people that while he did oppose Rand for a specific period of time, he was one of the few people that Rand kind of actually trusted more than just the average, oh, look, here's a scheming nobleman. And
yeah. More than that, I think he kind of actually popped our...
He went to Haddonmurk with a bunch of other nobles and roused the opposition against Rand, but Rand appreciated the fact that he was honest about it and never tried to scheme or manipulate. He just picked up and left when Rand took over the Stone of Tyr and raised a rebellion against him, but apparently Rand perceived that he was an honorable man and basically ended up just giving him the crown. Although Min did foresee Darlan wearing the crown that had a slightly curved sword on it. She said, I saw him wearing a crown. I don't know what country it was from. But.
Yeah, and then she said, oh, yeah, you're going to be king. Well, I know exactly what your crown should look like.
And yeah, exactly.
Yeah, here it is from...
And who your queen will
chapter,
be.
Yeah. Knife of Dreams, Chapter 22. Rand visits High Lord Darlin and Lady Carlane and Alanin, the son of Tyr. Some other nobles are with him. Rand orders Darlin to raise and take Ardoman. Vera arrives with news that the rebels will settle if Darlin is made king of Tyr. So, I guess Rand did hand it to him, but at least a part of it is so that that the rebels would stop rebelling. That's kind of... So that the rebels would, you know, just kind of get everybody together so that we can take care of the bigger threat, which isn't me.
Yeah, no, the other reasons, now that it's coming back to me now, that Darlin seems to be in better graces with Rand than everyone else is that Darlin specifically helped in getting Carolyn de Modred out when Thane's creepy mist attack of doom, which ultimately resulted in Rand getting the second unhealing wound in his side, took place. And Darlin was one of the people who was working actively to get everyone out and ended up helping get Rand out when he was wounded.
Carried him out on his back.
So it's honestly, yeah, Darlin Cisnera is a much more noble individual than he might originally be given credit for, and despite the fact that his name sounds a lot like Sinister.
And do you remember the first time that we actually meet Darlin?
Oh, yeah.
Knocked him out in the stomach here with a quarterstaff.
Yeah, he wasn't such a nice guy then. You will be honored to die on the blade of the High Lord, Darlin, Cisnera, peasant. Aw, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Matt with the staff. I mean, there are so many great scenes of Matt with the quarterstaff.
I know. I loved it when Julian said that staff, that oar that you call a staff. That was before he had his Ashwandara, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. I think he first met Julian. And then, of course, the epic battle between him. With him against Galad and Gollum, where he was sick and trounced them both. I love it.
Yeah, I love that. It's one of my very favorite scenes of all time. Of all time. That is one of the best. That is absolutely pure vintage Matt. In fact.
So, moving onward, there is one more point of view in this chapter.
Okay, then the next point of view in this chapter is our good friend Grendel, and she has moved herself to a hiding place on an island in the Arith Ocean with only six of her pets, one a Tyran High Lady. A gateway opens and a messenger summons her to Moradin's fortress. Moradin is angry that Arangar is dead. Grendel feigns confusion, countering that she was following orders to cause Rand pain. The remorse Lutheran must feel for destroying all of Natrin's barrow would be incredible. Moradin seems almost convinced. She vaguely remembers once having felt remorse, but other Forsaken, such as Semirag, were corrupt from the start. Moradin says he will leave her without punishment, for now, and she wonders if that was a direct order from the Great Lord or from Shadar Haran. He then orders her to stay away from Rand. She offers to bring in Perrin instead. She knows where his army is, and she has planned a trap with her Shadowspawn army. He takes her to a storeroom filled with one-power objects, including three binders, a shock lance, a Makar, and a dream spike. He has two dream spikes, actually. He loans her one of the dream spikes and warns her against using it against him because he will know. He also loans her the man with two souls. He tells her that she will be greatly rewarded if she kills Perrin Ibarra. He then shows her a book of dark prophecy that says that Perrin will die at the hands of the Shadow. Moradin sends her back to her island, and she can still test the true power, but only a little bit. I think that was almost as good as a Forsaken Tea Party, but not quite.
No, not quite. And if I may really quick, the prophecy to which they were referring is in the end of the book, and I'm just going to read a little bit. And in that day when the one-eyed fool travels...
It is
beyond creepy. And in that day, the one-eyed fool travels the halls of mourning, and the first among vermin lifts his hand to bring freedom to him who will destroy. The last days of the fallen blacksmith's pride shall come. Yea, and the broken wolf, the one whom death has known, shall fall and be consumed by the midnight towers, and his destruction shall bring fear and sorrow to the hearts of men, and shall shake their very will itself. I almost had it until I messed it up at the end. So, we're not entirely sure, we can assume that that's the prophecy they're referring to, but we're not entirely sure what it means. Grendel and Moradin obviously interpret it to mean, well then, Perrin has to die. The fallen blacksmith, the broken wolf, he's gonna die. But,
the funny thing with that too, though, is that Moradin straight out, when she said, and Grendel says specifically, like, this says we're gonna kill Perrin Ibarra. And Moradin is very careful. He says, there are many different ways to read prophecies, but yes, that's what this says. I mean, I found that really incongruous. It's like, why offer the warning if you're going to then just agree that, yes, of course, that's what it means?
Yeah, I don't know. I sort of thought the fallen blacksmith, I sort of interpret that in an Aiel sort of way, where he's fallen in the way that the Tuatha'an are fallen from, you know, well, the Aiel consider that the Tuatha'an are fallen from them, but actually it's the Aiel who are fallen from the way of the leaf. And blacksmiths have an almost sacred nature among the Aiel, who did exactly, of course, exist in the Age of Legends and were, you know, the Daishain, and basically similar to the Tinkers, which is, you know, what broke the Aiel so badly. Because Perrin is a blacksmith, and among the Aiel, a blacksmith will not pick up a spear. He doesn't fight. He's exempt from a lot of things. He can't be taken Daishain, you know, et cetera, et cetera. They have an almost sacred nature among the Aiel, and I suspect that that stems from something from the Age of Legends, which is why he's referred to in the Dark Prophecy as the Fallen Blacksmith, because Perrin definitely, although really a pacifist at heart, definitely has, he even thinks to himself, well, this blacksmith has picked up a spear, you know, well, in fact, it was an axe, but that's okay, and now he's got the hammer, but he kills, you know, and he kills actually very well. And he also has the connections to the wolves, and killing among wolves is just, you know, something that needs to be done. So I wonder if the fallen blacksmith doesn't refer to a more of a spiritual fall from what he should have been than an actual death, you know what I mean?
Well, here's an interesting, if we look at the wording there in the epilogue very closely, it says, the last days of the fallen blacksmith's pride shall come.
Yeah.
It's not talking about the fallen blacksmith's last days, really. I mean, after that, it goes on to Ye and the broken wolf, the one whom death has known, which is a very odd phrase as well, because death is personified in the spelling of the language. Shall fall and be consumed by the midnight towers. There are a couple of really dicey bits there, because the last days of somebody's pride is, you know, it can actually be a very good thing when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Perrin probably does have a good deal of pride in the idea of, oh no, I'm not a leader. I'm just a blacksmith. I'm just going to be who I am and worry about my stuff and not worry about other people. And when, you know, he finally gives up being prideful and accepts that he has to command people, well, then, you know, he becomes a better person overall. So I really think that prophecy has probably been misinterpreted. And, you know, honestly, if we're looking for a happy ending to the end of the series, yeah. I could see that.
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting, because when I think about something that Perrin would have a lot of pride in, and I think about the Two Rivers, Perrin is a lord, and he has a lot of land that he is lord over, not only the Two Rivers, but also Gildian. The ruler of Gildian is
liege
lord. So he owns Gildian and other places. I once saw it characterized as the boot of Perrin, just kind of the area of land in Sapdea, kind of through, Endor and, Emmonsfield and into Gildian. But, this idea that all this land falls and gets consumed by the Midnight Towers, that seems like where the Seanchan are taking it over to me. Which also to me seems like something that would have to happen after the last battle, because there's not time for it to happen before. But I don't know. It could be that for the last battle, we know that there's Skullistan invading, Carrion, invading Camelin, and Camelin's in flames. You know, there's also the possibility that, the Two Rivers is being invaded. We don't know. But I have done other podcasts on this that we go into much, much, much more detail, and we talk for a long time on it. So I think we might want to leave it there for now in this episode, and then put people for other ones.
we previously recorded.
I did find in some places it said that, or it seems to say, that the Forsaken always have access to the true power, but using it without permission is, unwise. And other
good way to die.
Like, yeah. In other places, it seems like they don't have access. Like here, she says she can still touch the true power. It seems like she's surprised she has access, but she still has permission to use it because she wasn't told that she can still access it. And I might be misremembering how she should. I should have reread these chapters before we did a reread on them, maybe. But I don't know. There's hints and clues all through the book relating to how the true power is used, and this is just another one to add to the pile, I think.
Very possible.
The drain spike, we see what that does later. The man with two souls, everyone knew when they read that this is Slayer. Luke is on Slayer. And we see how good a manipulator Grendel is, that she gets herself out of trouble for literally tying up Agenor so that he would die.
Well, that is interesting. I thought it was kind of interesting that Morin has acquired so many really rare objects of the power, and all to himself, apparently, where he found all that stuff. And how do you think, and this is kind of like a little aside too, but it's pretty well accepted that the Tyran noblewoman, that's one of the six pets that Grendel has in her hiding place on the island, is the High Lady Altima. And how do you suppose she ended up in Grendel's clutches? Do you think she was a dark friend from day one and just got scooped up? Or do you think Grendel collected her because she was pretty enough to be a pet?
Yeah, well, we know that there are dark friends all over the place. We know that there are two of them among the ruling class, quote-unquote, in here. And so it's not too far of a stretch that she could go anywhere she wanted and have anyone she wants.
She was also the one that was, she visited Morghaze in Andor when she was under Robin's thumb, and basically Robin used compulsion on her to make her one of his pets. So maybe he just passed her along to Grendel somehow
Grendel
when he died.
Over when she, when Grendel when he took died. Her over after Rand killed Gabriel or Robin and
Bale fired him.
Yeah, and then, we know that Grendel showed up shortly after that to take care of Asmodian, so she could have picked her up then.
Yeah, so she snatched up a few extra pets on the way. That was a good day. Bale fired Asmodian, got some new pets, yeah.
Yeah.
It was a really very eventful day. Lancier and Moraine died that day, Robin, Asmodian. I just have one other quick little question on this. How do you suppose even one of the Forsaken finds a hiding place on an island in the middle of the Arith Ocean where no one ever goes? I mean, you have to know something's there to gate there. You can't just, cruise around looking for an island by a gateway, can you?
Maybe. We recently got a tweet from Brandon verifying that among the Forsaken there are dreamers, both male and female, and it could be that Grendel is one of these and she just used need. Even if she wasn't, I think she would have enough knowledge of Teler and Andriad to be able to go into it and use need. Get around.
And just search around for a hiding place.
I need a good place to hide.
You're probably right. That's a good point. Any idea what a Remakar is good for? A Remakar?
It is an original version of the Psy.
Of the what?
Psy, the three-pronged thing.
Psy. Okay. Yeah, I actually know how to use those.
I don't. I know that
I don't hear very well, but I never said I was good at them, don't get me wrong. Nunchucks also
But rather than being used in a traditional way, it's actually used as a dowsing rod. Rather than looking for water, it looks for like ley lines of power and then just channels them into Balefire right then and there.
I use them to grow tomatoes.
Regardless of where it's point or when you want it to shoot or whatever, it's just once it finds a ley line that's sufficient or node of sufficient density in one tower, it'll just automatically channel that into a stream of Balefire.
Oh, okay.
So
let me send you mine.
Pointing it at any given time.
You want me to send you mine so you can douse with them? I'm not using them anymore. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it should be noted that EncyclopediaWatt.org, who has graciously allowed us continually without any real asking or prompting any way, shape, or form to use their chapter summaries as the basis for our own chapter summaries, sometimes more or less verbatim, has a special note on the Remicar, and it literally says, no idea what a Remicar is good for.
I sort of thought maybe it might be like the original version of the replicators in Star Trek. You know, I think that would be kind of cool, but...
No, I know what
not
it is.
Not the replicators in Stargate, Star Trek. Totally different thing.
I know what it is. I just saw this online recently. It's the coolest thing. It's a fire extinguisher, only rather than having to stand and point it, whatever, it's just a canister that you throw. And then it breaks and the gases expand and put out the fire.
Hmm.
That's what it is. It's a portable, throwable fire extinguisher.
Okay.
And I will find a link for that now and share it with you because it's absolutely
See, I was going to say it was either like a massage chair or...
Yeah, that sounds good. I could use that right now.
or some other form of things that wasn't necessarily
deadly. Don't go there. I was sort of leaning toward the old vibrating beds that they had in the PG motel. Yeah, you put a quarter in and...
No, more than likely, given...
like a little better in the Age of Legends.
I don't know. Given Morden's penchant for the objects in this room, I mean, let's look at what else is in the room.
Three binding rods.
three oath rods.
A shock lance.
Shock lance. It seems like, he's building a stockpile of things that, you know, two dream spikes, although one of them is conspicuously absent.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, actually...
I already have that.
He had two, but it wasn't absent then when she saw them, but later it was.
I thought he said the other one is in use. I thought that was his statement, is that he was already using the other one.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you may be right. Moving right along to the next chapter, entitled Questioning Intentions, we have the entire chapter being seen from Morgaze's point of view. And we enter with Morgaze serving tea during a meeting with Perrin, Elias, Tam, Balwer, Jur Grady, Sionid, Mysteri, Anora, Berylane, Aleandra, Glenn, Arganda, Aravine, Navarin, Adara, and the other four wise ones. Niald is still recovering from the snake bites. Navarin reports that the blight spot has been eradicated. The officers remind Morgaze of Gareth Bryn. She does not understand why she banished him, Aemlyn, and Melorian. She cultivated her serving skills under Savannah, and that's why she's doing so well serving tea now. Gabriel and then Valda taught Morgaze that one's station in life can change. The people at the meeting then move to discussing following the road to catch up with Basil Gill and the others. Morgaze has mixed emotions about Perrin. He is a promising leader, but in her eyes, he is also a rebel. Aleandra asks if he still needs to send her back to Johanna, and he says yes. She wants to remain under his banner. Angrily, he calls in Will Alcine and orders all the wolf banners burned. Every one. They then discuss returning people to their homes. Balwer reports that the gateways to return all these people to their homes will take hours, even days, and Grady and Neil are still not strong enough to do this. Fiona suggests going to Rand and Carrion. Perrin says he is not there, but he will not explain how he knows this. Perrin then agrees to send scouts to Carrion to learn more. Adara then brings forward a suggestion for making larger gateways involving forming a circle between the Ashim and Wise Ones and the Aes Sedai. Perrin tells him to start practicing this. The scouting party will include Sionid, her warders, two maidens, Kael Adair, Kamael Nalathian, and Balwer. Morgaze wonders if Balwer has told Perrin who she really is. She wishes that she could be a resource to Elaine and Andor. Tedrin Nael has told her that Gabriel is dead and that Rand now holds Caemlyn. Has Elaine returned to Caemlyn? Morgaze sees Talonvar standing outside the tent. Perrin sees Talonvar as well and tells him to come in. He then says that he wants them to marry. Incensed, Morgaze refuses and chews him out. Perrin is embarrassed and Talonvar is hurt. Sulan then returns from scouting with news that there is a White Cloak army on the road in front of them, blocking their way. In case anybody wanted to know, the other wise ones are Coel, Delora, Janina, and Marlene. I know you're all dying to know that.
This is... ostensibly... this is one of those chapters where we're supposed to get you know, inner thoughts from Morghese, learning about, you know, who she really is and what her place in the world is. I personally find it horribly, horribly irritating that Morghese and Elaine seem to share the trait of, oh, I really like Perrin, but he's a rebel. It's like, you know what? Seriously? Your dynasty has ruled in Camelin for, you know, what? How old is Morghese and how old was she when she took the throne? You know?
Yeah, one generation.
20, 30 years now. Okay, we understand. But at the same time, Perrin has said from the very beginning in, you know, Morghese's presence, yes, I'm raising this banner. I don't make any claim towards being a lord or, you know, having anything. The only reason we're raising the Manethrin banner in the first place is so that we can pass without having to be, like, accosted by every band of random criminals that show up on the road. Leave us alone. And it seems like they have blinders. They're like, oh, but he raised a banner, therefore he must be rebelling. No.
Yep.
Talk
to
the man.
He's a rebel, never be any good.
Perrin is not your dentist.
I know. It's really kind of sad. And then later on in the book, I think Elaine goes completely over the edge, you know, with that attitude to where, once again, I wanted to haul her off the throne and slap her silly. I just like, don't get me on an Elaine rant. But between that and my babes are safe, Nin saw it, you know, you just want to shake her till her teeth rattle. I want to thump her till she'll think she's had an adventure like Nynaeve did wanted to do to Brigitte. Like mother, like daughter. I think the only two really interesting things in this chapter and the previous chapter are that two characters that have been sort of noticeably lacking in insight and self-awareness are actually starting to acquire a little bit of it. You know, Morghese with her understanding about her changed position in life. You know, she's not a queen, never going to be a queen again. And Galad in the last chapter actually having enough, what's the word I'm looking for? Not compassion, but having enough awareness that he realized that Chibane was being hostile to him because he felt his job was threatened by Gawain's presence and his station, you know, and actually took some steps to try and ease that situation a little bit. That was a big stride forward in Gawain's, you know, personal development. I don't see Morghese making quite that big of a step here, but you can see that, you know, she's coming along, even to such a simple thing as being proud of how well she's serving the tea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a start, you know.
Well, I mean, and it's really interesting because they touch again very lightly on what was slightly more than implied that she went through. I mean, we all know that Morghese was a puppet, essentially, for Raavan.
Yeah.
I mean, there was nothing she could do about that, but literally what Valda put her through was worse, and she's consistently reminded of it.
Yeah.
And it brings it back. I mean, it is a slightly darker edge in the series that, you know, that Morghese suffered pretty much, you know, physical and sexual abuse at Valda's hand just because he could.
Yeah, and torture at the hands of Asanoa.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was, you know, relatively mild, it was still enough to break her, you know, break her spirit a little bit there. I mean, obviously she didn't lose any body parts or anything, but it wasn't pleasant at all.
No.
So, yeah, you know, there's some pretty bad guys in this series of books. And Valda and Asanoa, I think, are two of the most disgusting.
But they're both dead now, so we can be happy.
Yes. The late and unlamented Aemon Valda. I think this chapter and the previous chapter, what I kind of think of as bridge chapters, they're basically setting up a scene to come, you know, rather than being important in and of themselves. I think the only other really significant thing is that, you know, Perrin is, of course, still seeing the visions of Rand every time he thinks of him or speaks his name, and now he's beginning to feel the pull of the Taverinus in Rand's direction. He knows that he's needed. He's accomplished what he needed to do. I sort of think that Perrin has probably been feeling this pull all along. He just was so obsessively focused on getting Fael back that he ignored it and everything else going on around him to achieve that end. Well, we're sure seeing a lot more signs of gateway dependence.
Yes, This is true.
They're ever going to be able to get around without that again.
Well, a little later, Nynaeve has a chapter, I think, where she makes a conscious decision that she is going to walk rather than opening a gateway.
Yeah.
Because people are getting too dependent on them. And I applaud her for that.
Yeah, I think she thinks our own feet hardly seem good enough for us anymore. Something of that nature. Yeah. I couldn't say if I could do gateways, I probably wouldn't be walking much except for exercise. And then, you know, these poor Ashaman, I mean, Perrin is just mean on these guys to the point of insanity. I mean, they're just worn out all the time. You know, the meals and Grady.
Yeah, true.
And, you know, why can't you make another gateway, an even bigger gateway, and get all these people out of here? It's like, gee, Perrin, you have any idea what you're asking? No, he doesn't. No, he does not. But this is interesting, too, that they said where she came up with it. Somebody had been talking about it. I'm trying to remember if it was some of the Aes Sedai or whatever, but this is one of the first really practical suggestions that we've had for forming a circle with the men. And I think it's interesting that it's coming from a wise one. And she wants to form a circle with, you know, the Ashaman, the wise ones, and the Aes Sedai. That's kind of cool. And we're going back to the age of legends where the greatest accomplishments were achieved by men and women channeling together, usually linked. And poor Talonvor, I gotta say, poor Talonvor reminds me a lot of the character in the first, I think it was the first one, Pirates of the Caribbean. You know the guy, Commodore,
Norrington.
Norrington, thank you. Yes, Commodore Norrington. You know, the poor guy hangdogging around this gal who just can't be bothered. You know, she's like, well, I really like you, but I don't really like it that much. And, you know, but don't go away. Stay close. But, yeah, I don't really want to marry you. But, you know, there's this guy over here who's so cute, you know. You know, Morgaine doesn't do that to him, but, oh my God, she's just dancing him around like some kind of an idiot. And he's just such this noble, good-hearted guy, just wants to do the right thing by this woman, and she's just like leading him a merry chase. Kind of embarrassing for Morgaine.
So our final chapter for this podcast will be Chapter 7, Lighter Than a Feather. It begins with Lon and Beulen having traveled for weeks, and they are now on the Plain of Lances, near the border between Kandor and Saldea. Lan bought Beulen a horse, and he still has the pack horse, whose name is Scouter. Beulen suggests that they go south at Burned Crossing, then east to South Meddler, a much better road, but Lon declines. They pass an inn, and three men from the inn begin to follow them. Lon is prepared for them to be bandits, but they see, but then sees that two of them are wearing Hadori. They are Andre, Nazar, and Rakim. Lon refuses to let them join him, but the three decide to ride in the same direction anyway. Lon grudgingly rides Mandarb onward. From there, we switch to Galad. Galad is eating his morning meal when Biar comes from scouting Perrin's camp. He says they fly the flags of Gilladan and Maine. The Wolfhead banner is no longer up. Biar insists that Perrin killed Bornhald the Elder. He is from the Two Rivers, and Galad remembers that that the Two Rivers is Rand's home as well. We shift again from Galad to Perrin. Perrin is eating ham for breakfast, and Fael thinks that it's a completely gross custom. She refuses to wear her golden belts anymore. She carries a blue stone on a cord. She goes to breakfast with Aleandre. They remain camped along the Jehanna Road. The White Cloak army is blocking their path to Luggard. Gaul then enters to make a report to Perrin. The point of view then shifts again, back to Galad. Biar tells Galad that they fought Trollocs in the Two Rivers. Niall sent them there for that purpose. The Two Rivers, he says, is full of dark friends. He says even farmers can be dangerous, and Galad ruefully agrees, remembering a particular encounter with a young farmer with a quarterstaff. D'Ar is certain that Perrin is Shadowspawn and that he brought the Trollocs to the Two Rivers. He also killed two of the Children of the Light in Andor when D'Ar was under the command of Jaev from Bornhold. Orotar and Bornhold can confirm his stories. From this point, it shifts once again back to Perrin. Gull reports that the White Cloaks are holding their people. Elias recognized Basil Gill, and Sulin reports the same. Gull is having trouble with both Bane and Chiad as Guy Shane. They also saw a banner over the camp and drew a picture. Seven Bulwer says that it means that the Lord Captain Commander is in the camp. Perrin remembers meeting a Lord Captain the night Hopper died, or the first time that he killed a man. From here, once again, the point of view flashes back to Galad. B'Ar presses Galad, and he agrees that Perrin must be brought to justice. Alejandre has sworn fealty to Perrin. They may be able to make Geladan the new home of the Children of the Light. Again, the point of view reverts to Perrin, and Perrin thinks the White Cloaks must be here because of his Taveren effect. He cannot escape his past. They have 20,000 soldiers, which is not nearly as many as Perrin, and they have no channelers because they're Children of the Light. At this point, the point of view shifts once again to Galad, who agrees that they must move against Perrin, and shifts finally back to Perrin's point of view, concluding the chapter with Perrin ordering that they find a better place to camp, to send more scouts, and to offer the Children of the Light a parley. They must free Basil Gill and the others. I actually really liked the construction of this chapter.
Wait, flips back and forth?
Yes. You know, we get a really quick reminder of what's going on with Lon, which is all good, because we didn't see him for most of the last book, if any of the last. So we're getting a little updates here and there, but mostly Lon right now is pulling a Lord of the Rings. He's going a great distance, and not a lot is actually happening. So we're fine with not seeing a whole bunch, other than I find it amazingly amusing that, you know, the three men are, they come out from the inn, and they're riding on, and Lon's like, I won't have you following me. And they kind of turned around, they're like, well, last I checked, you were behind us, so technically doesn't that mean you're following us?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we have a little bit of humor to go along with Lon seemingly trudging his way towards his own death.
Well, that's one of my favorite scenes, actually, and I think I actually used that quote earlier in an email. You think it's Andera or Andir?
I've always said Andere.
Andere? Anyway, Andir or Andere, Lon grumps at him, this path leads only to death. And Andre sort of shoots back over his shoulder, well, if this path leads only to death, then the trail will be a lot easier than I expected. It just cracks me up every time. It's like, you know, you got to love the mucky area.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, and then after that, we get this back and forth between Perrin where you know that the conversations are happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
And they're on such very, you know, similar basis. I mean, they're both talking and thinking about the same things. And you see Perrin and Galad getting pulled closer and closer together so that, you know that they're going to be more than linked. They're going to be, you know, directly tied to one another very, very tightly, because the pattern is just, I mean, it's coming to, you know, some intricate piece of the pattern with them twisting together and their threads combining. So.
And then we've got the additional twist that Rand is a very close friend of Perrin's, and Perrin is now going to be a fairly close friend with his half-brother.
Exactly.
His heretofore unknown half-brother.
I can't wait to see that meeting.
Yeah, that should be good. I hope it's going to be a little bit more, or I should say, I hope it's going to be a little less anticlimactic than the Armorland's anger, because I really thought when Rand met Egwene, we were going to see some serious sparks flying, but it was sort of, oh, okay. Yeah,
yeah, there wasn't much anger in that chapter.
I have to kind of you'll give a slight nod and a laugh at, you know, Nifail. I can't believe you're eating ham for breakfast. Who eats ham for breakfast? And parents
like
response,
normal people, you know.
Perrin's response is a little gruffer than I would expect from Perrin, but it also is, it seems extremely appropriate. It's like, what? I like ham.
Yeah, and he also says that very sensibly. He says that, what difference if you eat ham at the midday or if you eat ham in the morning? You know, you're still eating ham. What's the difference? You know, not in those words, but that's the gist of it.
Like, yeah, but I love it. It's like, you know, well, what does it matter when I eat my ham? I like ham. It's like, why are you bothering me about this?
I know. If I eat it now or 3 hours later, there's some difference, you know? I know. People get really locked into that sort of thing. It's really funny.
Particularly because there's another scene involving ham later, and it was just, you know. So, you know, it's nice that we get these little kind of congruity things where, you know, something they talk about earlier in the book shows back up later, and it's just like...
Well, the only thing I can say about the ham is that I really want to know where they got that ham. I mean, that's actually one of the things that bothers me the most about this last, actually, two books, maybe three, really. Once we started getting these huge armies of people, I mean, we're having basically worldwide drought and no crops have come up all year and, you know, everything is brown and dying and everything like that. And somehow, some way, Perrin and all these other commanders are able to feed these 100,000 people or whoever. I mean, they've got 50,000 on the road. Wow, that's not easy. You know, you just can't, I mean, up to a point you can take along pigs and goats and stuff like that, but if you're doing a really long march, that doesn't last long. Pigs and goats aren't designed for marching. Or chickens either. You can carry those in cages, I guess. And really, you need supply lines to move an army of that size. You really do need supply lines. I mean, Rand ranted on and on about needing wagons, and he was right. You know, the Romans knew that. You don't go marching huge numbers of people halfway across the world without some idea how you're going to provision them.
Well, either of you know this, but any and all of our listeners who have ever played Minecraft will know that in order to get ham, you just go and hit a pig until it dies and you get 2 pork chops.
Well, there you go. Okay. Works for me.
Yes, I think...
Well, you just go to the local grocery store and get some. What's the deal, you know?
Yeah. And I think... boar ribs and various other boar meats, which can be cooked in World of Warcraft, is like an 80% drop rate off of wild boar outside of Orgrimmar.
There you go.
So, you know,
I've been bold a few times, you're good.
It's like, dude, Costco,
now
okay?
That raises an interesting question. Do the Aes Sedai, or indeed any of the channelers, think to hunt their food, obviously when they need to hunt their food, with the power?
It depends on whether you consider killing food using the power as a weapon.
Well, that would explain why the Aes Sedai do it, but what about the other channelers? I wouldn't.
Oh, I'm sure the wise ones do all the time.
The wise ones.
And the Ashaman, they don't care. They have no 3Os.
Well, yes, but if...
I'd also be surprised if the Ashaman, one of their chores is to hunt food with the power.
That would probably... Yeah, because... It would teach you a little more precise control, killing with the power. It's like, you know, if all I do is blow things up, we're not going to eat very much.
Yeah, it's not much of a ham chop, if you blow it to shreds.
Nope.
It makes me wonder, you know, like...
Pig, most effectively, like, you cut it with a gateway.
Oh, yeah.
What's on the menu today? Oh, chili again.
Pulled pork. Ground sausage.
Sausage, chili, and pulled pork.
Yeah. It makes me wonder
anything
now, though, you know, like...
ground pork. Or beef.
It makes me wonder, you know, like the blue Aja had their little weave for attracting or repelling insects. Maybe the Ashaman have developed some weaves for attracting boar or pigs.
It actually wouldn't surprise me.
Venison or, sausage.
You just come walking in and turn into sausage. Well, I know they turned a lot of those IU into sausage, but I don't think they saved anything.
Oh,
that you might as well. Yeah, they ground them up pretty good. It was disgusting.
At least the question, if you blow up a pig, How do you collect the meat?
It's all mixed with the dirt and everything. It's really disgusting.
Oh, I'm sure that... Look, there's a weave for turning feathers into flowers. I'm sure there's a weave for sifting pig remains out of the dirt.
Well, don't get me started with the turning feathers into flowers. I'd really like to know how Rand did that, because that's pretty unusual in
I'd love to know how he got the winter lily.
The what?
The lily in winter? The whatever kind of lily it was.
Oh, well, he could have just cruised around until he... Yeah, he could have just gone someplace warm until he found something cool. You know, that I could understand, but...
Yeah, but he wouldn't...
Or maybe he knew... Maybe he knew where there was a handy greenhouse somewhere. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, but he wouldn't have, because he would want to make up for the fact that he didn't give her the flower before.
Yeah. But, you know, there really aren't very many instances of people turning one thing into another with the power. And that one, I kind of think it was a mistake, because you really... I mean, they don't... I mean, this is not charms class. You can't just, you know, you can't just change that, you know, symbol into a whatever.
Do you ever wonder?
A mouse into a teapot or something?
He's the dragon reborn, okay? He was the strongest channeler of the Age of Legends. I'm sure knowledge of how to do these things. But we just...
Yeah, well, and Nakomi, too, you know, she did a little candy magic, too.
You know what I wonder? I wonder if Elaine still has those feathers.
I bet she does.
Because I remember she remembered to scoop up the feathers because it was such a sweet gesture, and, you know, she...
You wanted them to be a flower.
Aww. Yeah.
I'm sure she still got them. They're wrapped in a silk handkerchief, and they're one of her most prized possessions. That hasn't changed.
I kind of wonder if we saw... Because weren't there some times when Elaine and Nynaeve were with Val and Lucas traveling circus, I mean show, and going through their personal possessions? I seem to recall that there were times, and I don't remember if the handkerchief was specifically mentioned, but where Nynaeve saw something in Elaine's stash, was like, what is that? And Elaine's like, nothing. I don't know. I could be flying way off base here.
There very might have been. I don't really recall at the moment.
But I'm sure that she has a nice spot in her chamber someplace that is reserved for feathers and flowers.
Oh, I just had a thought. Now it's gone. Oh, well. Oh, I know who else has something that they've saved for a long time. I'll bet you, Swan says, I'll bet you a fish scale to a gold coin I don't have that Loyal still has that fresh flower that Aerith gave him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we know that Avienda still has that bracelet.
Yeah, that's true. She does. The ivory bracelet carved with thorns, roses and thorns. I think it's cool that Egwene got an ivory bracelet, I guess from Avienda, carved with flames. You know, for the flame of Tarvalon, I suppose. That's a little foreshadowing. Very interesting.
There were also a couple of really nice look-backs in this chapter. We got to see, you know, obviously the nod back to Matt trouncing Galad and Gawain with the quarterstaff. Wonderful, because honestly, I think that trouncing gave Galad more of a lesson than it did, pardon me, Gawain. Even though both of them do remember that incident within the last two books, both of them have fought back to Matt beating them up with the quarterstaff. we also get, and again, this is in the Ham episode, we get a nod back to Fael's treatment, and it shows that Fael's time with the Aiel... Oh, God, that's terrible to say. Fael's time with the Aiel really did have a profound effect on her. She will not wear golden jewelry that reminds her of her time serving under Sivana. You know, she gives all of her jewelry away or sells it, you know, which is wonderful because it can be used for resources. But at the same time, it is also a nod that it was so traumatic for her being, you know, Sivana's servant and having to wear the gold belts and everything that, you know, she just won't. She'll make sure it's a nice sturdy leather belt, but never again with any gold or jewels there. And then, of course,
fire drops, yeah.
And then, of course, she also gets the blue stone, which was given to her by Roland. Which also eventually will come up in a later chapter in this book, as well as...
Didn't she salvage that from the bodies rather than be given it? I thought that
you're
was
right. You're
was,
right. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, so it was.
They all went and got some mementos or something. They had the maidens go get them mementos from the four brothers or whatever, and the maiden that got
yes.
the name of the Shafail yeah. took up with.
It is yeah. kind of interesting to see how a lot of the women in this book react to their traumatic events. I mean, Egwene still, I think, has nightmares about having the Adam around her neck. And how many months did she spend as a Sildan? Because I know that there was some, because it's, when Rand portal stoned them to Falmay, there were a few months that were just lost.
They lose like 5 or 6 months. They lose, almost a year in transit, if I remember properly. They lose a lot of time.
I don't know if it was a year, but I know it was definitely months. They changed seasons for sure.
Yeah, I could have sworn it was like 5 or 6 months.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, let me look up the Watt chronology, which someone has put together, and I don't know who put it together, but it's a great resource. Let me go Great Hunt and see what we can find out here. So, okay, so Rand takes them through the portal stone in Amadane 26 or so, which terms that we would use is about July 4th. And in September is when Leandrin takes them to Toman Head, and they get and Egwene and Min are captured. And in November, Rand arrives in Toman's Head. So it's only a couple months. November 20th, let's see, so...
Just around 4 months.
Yeah, day 184 to day 243 is when she spent. And now I'm going to have to pop up because I can't do math on the fly.
Yeah, that's so weird. I mean, what actually happened to them? They were in some sort of stasis or something?
Days.
You'd think that they would have all starved to death or something in that 59 days. You know, I mean, they're experiencing things, so they should have not been in complete stasis. But that's a long time to go without food or water for them or a horse, either one.
She was only a Demane for 59 days, and it still had such an effect on her that she's constantly, mm-hmm. I mean, that she became creepy lady, and we compare that to Fael, who spent several months, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't we get a final count in Knife of Dreams of how many knots?
I thought it was something like, actually, I think they were relatively similar. I could have sworn, like, it was like the 60-somethingest knot.
Yeah, he was up to a lot of knots, that's for sure.
Yeah,
51 knots.
Yeah, it's about the same. But yeah, it's still for I don't remember how long the months are in Wheel of Time. I guess I could look that up.
I think the months are the same, but the weeks are 10 days.
The wiki page for Wheel of Time has some interesting things, including various word counts, audio book counts, and projections for the end of the series. So that currently, if A Memory of Light is its projected 300,000 plus words, the current totals, so not including A Memory of Light, there are currently 11,308 pages, 635 chapters, 4,062,312 words, and the total audio series up to this point is 17 days, 11 hours, and 30 minutes.
I love it. Oh, my
that's
God.
Nothing.
That's a pretty good chunk
hey,
of your life right there.
I can finish that in 3 weeks. Of constant listening.
Yeah, I've pretty much been, well, actually, up until about 2 weeks ago, I was pretty much all Towers of Midnight all the time, in the car anyway, and then I decided to go back and listen to Gathering Storm instead. And I was actually really shocked, because strangely enough, I don't have as much time to actually read as I used to in better days, but I do get a chance to listen to the audiobooks, and I didn't do that as much with The Gathering Storm. And having listened to that again recently, I was actually kind of amazed at how many things I'd missed. You know, some parts of it just seemed almost new to me, and I know part of that's because the first time I read it through in about 36 hours, and I was just recovering from pneumonia, and I know a lot of it went, you know, into nowhere land because I was sick. And then I read through it again at a slightly slower pace, but evidently still a lot of it just didn't stick. And since then, I've only really just referred to it a lot. I haven't really read it through, so I was kind of like, oh, I don't remember that. It's kind of embarrassing, really. I'm glad I was alone.
So that's going to handle us for today. Next episode, we'll get into all the wonderfulness that is Matt in Chapter 8, which, if you remember, was the one that we unlocked through the Great Hunt that was done via Brandon traveling all over the friggin' globe and planting clues, and it was great.
Yeah, the seven stripe laugh.
And so that's going to be fun, because Matt is a fun character. And if you want to get a hold of us, there are many ways you can do it, but I think the best way to give you right now, because we don't know when this is coming out, so we probably shouldn't get the new number, is via email, which is podcast@dragonmount.com.
You can also, of course, find us at our host site at dragonmount.com, which will also give links to our current voicemail number and the forums, which have a separate discussion page for the podcast itself.
That's right. And if you can find it, you can also meet us at the Happy Throng, which is hosted by our esteemed leader, Master Denizel. Well, not really.
It's hard, though. Camelin is not easy to get to.
No, it's hard to find the Happy Throng. And he has that, don't try to get that portrait of Rand off the wall, because he's got it heavily guarded.
Yeah, let me tell you, there are no good flights into the wetlands. I mean, the closest you can get is Shara. And you have to hook it from there. It's a pain.
The easiest directions to Camelin from where you are is second star on the right and stop at about 7:30.
Or you see that red star over the building there? Just follow that. Oh, until it sets. Oops. The red star sets over Shadowlobo. Yeah, I like it. That could be a book all by itself.
We also have a Facebook and Twitter, but those are, you know, whatever. Those aren't as cool as meeting in person at fictional.
Yeah. And then there's also, of course, the ubiquitous Message Cow.
Message Cow Gateway.
If you're going to send me a message, Cow, send me also a message, potato, butter, and chives.
Yep. Absolutely.
I say this because we just decided to thaw a steak for tomorrow night's dinner, so I'm now thinking I might want to go out and buy a potato.
LOL, the message
buy
cow.
Buy at least two potatoes.
Andrew's consuming the message cow as we speak. Oh, no!
But as always, as a public service warning and a safety warning and something that you should always do, When using gateways, exercise extreme caution. Send ahead first a message to Charm so that you don't accidentally cut someone's servant in half or their cat.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Virginia. I know you love that doll. I'll make it up to you sometime.
Yeah, sure you will. Well, and now we have to have the obligatory disclaimer that no actual cows or other animals were harmed in the making of this podcast. And this is Virginia saying, may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
For myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Staravinento Manchima, Taishite.
The Fourth Age podcast is brought to you by DragonMount.com. To contact us, visit our website, DragonMount.com/podcast.